A story really is a conversation. It is a conversation with yourself, with like the writer talking to themselves, but it's also a conversation with the audience, and that you're trying to figure something out. There is a problem that you're kind of looking at, that you're kind of wondering about. It could be about, like, you know, whether love can survive everything, the concept of fate, like, are we really fated to do this stuff? It could just be, you know, a mild, like, little issue of just, like, could, like, is it possible for this person just to have a good day? Or something along those lines. Like, there's a larger question usually for a lot of the stories. They don't all have to have them, but the ones that really stick with you, that you keep coming back to, that you can, like, iterate on a little bit more, those have a theme of some kind hidden underneath it. It is, and I think it's important for both the characters and the world character itself to be a little to refer back to or be somewhat obsessed with or preoccupied with these problems. These people are a manifestation or are facets of these problems in the world itself.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 91 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How are you, MJ?
Hello. I am doing great. How are you?
Doing very well. I'm still at my in-laws' bedroom, and I have some books that you can go buy. Go support MJ's work. Picking up her debut novel, Among Thieves, and the sequel, Thick as Thieves. Or for anyone out there wanting to review the book on Goodreads, Thick Ass Thieves.
Yes.
If you want some good heists, some good action, lots of hatchets, pirates, and all kinds of fun shit, go pick up the Tales of Tamora duology. As well, if you want to check out the cover for my debut novel, Mushroom Blues, you can go take a look at that. It'll be on my social media accounts. It'll be on my website, adrianmgibson.com. The book is out on March 19th. So I hope you're in for a fun ride full of mushrooms and mystery and all kinds of messed up stuff. But yeah, March 19th. As well, a quick note for everyone out there listening or watching, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live. So check the links in the description to support what we do here. As well, don't forget to rate and review us on the favorite podcast app and subscribe to the FanFlytic YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, joining us once again, the brilliant Robert Jackson Bennett, author of the Founders Trilogy, which starts with Foundry Side, and the Divine Cities Trilogy, which starts with City of Stairs. And since this episode is out after it releases, The Tainted Cup, go get yourself a copy. Just bask in that mad, weird, mysterious world. Robert, how are you? Welcome back to the show.
Doing good. It's good to be back.
Yeah, thanks, man. A heads up, this is part two of our two-part chat with Robert, so I recommend checking out part one to get to know him better. Today, though, we're making like Wi-Fi, talking about the connection between world and character. Before we dig deeper into the episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Novello is an exciting new publishing and reading platform whose goal is to be the go-to for all things writing and storytelling. Their platform offers an intuitive, user-friendly way for writers to create and share their awesome stories for readers to enjoy, all while maintaining total control over their stories. Everything from the content to cover art and pricing is all controlled by the story's author. Novello also offers social features such as message boards, direct messaging, and a news feed where you can post updates to your followers. With future plans including support for comics and a marketplace for users to sell other writing-related services, the future of this platform is looking bright. And the best part? It's all available for free. No sign-up fees, no membership, just a growing library of epic tales. Sign up now to bask in the magic of books, where you can enjoy tales like Blackwater, an epic adventure by an award-winning author, or Limbo, The Door Above the Lake, a terrifying battle for survival. Whether you're a casual reader or a professional writer, Novello is the place for you. Visit them at novello.com. That's N-O-V-E-L-O.com. And now, enjoy the rest of this episode of SFF Addicts. Kicking off this masterclass, let's ask a bit of a trap question. What is more important in fiction, in your opinion, Robert, world or character?
I think the two are pretty well connected. I think that the world almost is a character, and the characters are kind of like constantly responding to the world. But as far as what makes people want to stay and hang out in the story, it's definitely character. It is not a fun experience to go to a super cool mansion and hang out with a bunch of fucking assholes.
That's what you say.
That's a great way to put it, though. It so is.
I mean, like, nobody wants to hang out with a bunch of shitty, boring people, no matter how cool the place looks. There's always a better party you could be going to with people that you actually like to be around. And that's why character, I think, is far more important than the world.
It's like what I imagine, like, Washington, D.C. and, like, politicians' parties to be like.
Once I've been to a couple of those parties, it's a bunch of phonies. I love it. Actually, what's kind of strange about that is that because those people are such practice phonies and basically, like, going to parties is a skill set, they're pretty good at it. And it can be a pretty good time. It's kind of the odd thing where the people who are the phoniest, bullshittiest people are actually the best to hang out with at a party because they know how to do it.
Right. They're good fair weather friends. Yeah.
Yes. Very good fair weather friends. You'll never see them again. They won't ever answer one of your calls. If they ever sense for a moment that there's someone more important to talk to, they will leave you in a second.
Yeah.
But for the moment you got them, they're pretty fun.
Sounds like a fun ass time.
Right? Sounds great.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Great. Well, so you mentioned that character is, or the world is kind of a character in a sense, which I want us to dig in a little bit more later. But first I want to ask, in your opinion, why is it so vital for stories to have that strong connection between world and character? And like, in what ways is that super important? And could it become disconnecting if the two aren't matched?
Well, I think the thing that kind of lies underneath this is the importance of theme in stories, which I think goes underlooked at, or is it overlooked? It goes overlooked. It's not looked at enough. because a story really is a conversation. It is a conversation with yourself, with like the writer talking to themselves, but it's also a conversation with the audience. And that you're trying to figure something out. There is a problem that you're kind of looking at, that you're kind of wondering about. It could be about, like, you know, whether love can survive everything, the concept of fate. Like, are we really fated to do this stuff? It could just be, you know, a mild, like, little issue of just, like, is it possible for this person just to have a good day? Or something along those lines. Like, there's a larger question usually for a lot of the stories. They don't all have to have them, but the ones that really stick with you, that you keep coming back to, that you can like iterate on a little bit more, those have a theme of some kind hidden underneath it. It is, and I think it's important for both the characters and the world character itself to be a little to refer back to, or be somewhat obsessed with or preoccupied with these problems. These people are a manifestation or are facets of these problems in the world itself. I think this goes for not only fiction and fantasy, but all kinds of stories, nonfiction as well. One of the best examples of world building is Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, which is the book that inspired Homicide Life on the Streets, the show The Wire. It's a nonfiction story about spending a year with homicide detectives in Baltimore. And this is, and it's written in present tense. It is a gangbusters example of capturing aspects of this world and presenting them in a way that make you feel like you're seeing a secret place, a secret tribe of people with their own rules and their own nature. Lots of characters, lots of character in the world itself. He's choosing which ones to show you, though. He's choosing them because he wants to articulate the issues with the war on drugs in Baltimore and how the social and institutional problems of Baltimore are incapable of dealing with these things. That's what preoccupies the world he depicts. That's what preoccupies or influences all the criminals that they're chasing. That's what preoccupies all the detectives. And once you kind of get into that, once he has you tuned into that channel that he's broadcasting, it makes the story richer and it makes it more resonant. And I think that that's really so I think that you really need to kind of start there with your concept of what am I really looking at here? So do I really want this to just be a world of which element can beat which element? Can rock beat fire? Can fire beat water? Or is this about something deeper, about tradition, about warfare, about whether or not it's ever right to take a life? I'm obviously talking about Avatar here. And once you kind of have that picked out, it becomes a lot easier for you to pick your voices who are for, against, trying to shove things in a different direction. And it also becomes a lot easier for you to pick the settings in your world that highlight or catalyze those conflicts. And once you kind of feel yourself moving directionally in the right way on that, then the theme becomes sharper and clearer, and then it informs everything just so much better. You kind of need to point yourself in the right way, let it inform the people that you're working with and the backdrop that you're working with. And then from there, and this is a lot of rewriting, a lot of reflecting on what you're doing. And then from there, once you realize kind of what the problem is, what they're working on, it becomes a lot easier to backfill and be like, oh, from the get-go, this person was trying to escape a life of wealth and luxury because they were looking for this. That's how writing is for me, at least. But yeah, what was the question?
No, you answered it.
About the importance of connection of character and world.
The importance of that connection. But it's kind of
it's all one conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, because you were talking about how theme and sort of the thematic underpinning of your story is one of those foundational things. And MJ and I were curious about, like, when you are starting a new project, if you started with world, plot, or character, and how certain elements come into play during your writing process. But it sounds like those might not even be the initial elements. It might be like what the sort of like underlying themes of this story are and how those characters or which characters might reflect that best and which settings might best help to exemplify that and bring the most out of the character and the theme. So it's really interesting that you kind of approach it from that way, because I know a lot of writers where they even say theme is not something I think about consciously. It's something that sort of I come to a realization at some point during the writing process or the editing process where that becomes a more tangible thing to them. So it is fascinating that, you know, do you have a very clear idea when you're writing a story that this is more or less what I want it to be about, and then let the world and the characters speak to that? Or how does it go?
Somewhat. I mean, I think that some of it's true. Like, you have to directionally point yourself in the right way. Like, I feel like, for example, for The Tainted Cup, it's a story about change. And about how a lot of times the things that we use to create the change, to protect ourselves and help ourselves, at some point in time, they calcify and become the thing keeping us from changing in the ways that we need to. It's like I made a choice when I started this series, that all the crimes that happen in the series, all the murders, will at some point be caused by someone saying, I refuse to change. I refuse to let this be changed. I don't want the world, I prefer the status quo. I don't want it to be any different. But the idea of someone saying, I don't want things to be different, and I refuse to let them be different. Even though Like, there are tremendous consequences for if you don't change. They would prefer that, or they just choose to believe that those wouldn't happen. That was always going to be at the heart of all the murders and crimes that take place in this series. And I realized that in Foundryside, the theme that I wanted to touch upon was about how technology grants power, but only for a little while. You think that you've built this gigantic fortress around yourself that makes you like impervious to attack, but in reality, someone's just going to invent something new that completely undermines it. And once I realized that, that was how I wanted all those characters to sort of be thinking and be operating. And really kind of like, once you have that sort of in your head, it makes it a lot easier. Like, one example that I think that is great at this is actually like Die Hard, which a lot of people don't think that there's a theme to Die Hard, but once you start to look at it, it's all sitting right there. For example, there's a part where, Hans Gruber asks the chief Japanese CEO dude, whose name I don't recall, where do you get your suits? And then they both reveal that they know each other's suit tailor and that like they all are kind of operating in the same circles. Once you establish that, you look at the rest of the story and you realize that this is a story about how like 80s like Reaganism sucks. It takes place in this giant, hollow, empty corporate structure. It's in LA where Christmas doesn't even really happen. There's no weather. They're both like raiders. Like one uses lawyers and one uses a gun. They don't believe in anything. Neither of them believe in any like larger creed. And like this is where it gets into like the politics of the time. But like here's how bad things have gotten like for the 80s. Like this guy's wife left him at Christmas to go get a job with like shoulder pads, like alongside dudes who were doing lines of coke in their office. And now she's changed her name. This is like the 80s have like undermined traditional marriage. And who's going to be the one to put it all right? A blue collar guy from the East Coast who doesn't even need to put on a shirt. To
let alone shoulder pads.
Suck all these idiots in the jaw. Yeah, totally.
He's like, going to crawl through an air duct to save you all.
Yeah, to save you all. Like this is about like blue collar macho guys getting back at all these like yuppie assholes. That's kind of what it is at its heart. Where like he's just got common sense know-how. And once you kind of realize that, like that informs everything else you see, where he's the one who actually has the thing. Like they have a part where the SWAT team like charges in and they have to run through a set of like rose bushes, and one guy's hand gets pricked on a thorn, he goes, "Ow!" And he sucks on it. But by then you've seen John McClane like get the shit beat at him again and again and again and keep going. You realize right away, these LA SWAT guys ain't got shit on John McClane. And like each moment is built around this like tension between John McClane and everybody else who is part of this like 80s world. It's great.
Crazy. Dude, I've never thought about it that way, but that is fascinating.
I know,
also,
it's a really great
best Christmas movie. Best Christmas movie.
It's a great Christmas film.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the day that I can show my kid that.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I want to build on what you said earlier about your worlds themselves being a character, because I that's honestly how I felt reading your work. So like the walled-in land and the Tainted Cup to me felt almost as much like an antagonist in a way as it was like a setting. And then, of course, in the Founders trilogy, there are several places where locations actually do have personalities, scribed personalities, but still. So how important is it for writers to kind of flesh out their worlds in such a way that they feel like distinct characters? And do you see any like potential pitfalls that writers could fall into where the world overshadows the characters themselves?
Yeah, I think the first thing you have to realize is from a plot perspective, what's going on at this moment? What is the character trying to achieve in this place? And how does this speak to the larger themes that are going on in the story? Once you realize the relationship to the action, you can use the setting to highlight that, to then ask, what is that character's relationship to the place that this is taking place in? That makes it a lot easier to backfill everything. In The Tainted Cup, kind of one of the aspects that I wanted to look at is, and I think it's very popular these days, to think of human like civilization as a nasty, broken thing that shouldn't be, and that like nature is better. Like the natural world is a better, more perfect place. It lives in unity. It's never changing. It's like the place in Bambi where they walk through the forest and there's blades of sunlight that come down and shine upon them. And I wanted to instead look at it from the aspect of like nature is just as nasty as we are. It's also always changing. And it's frequently hostile in lots of ways to one another. It's just hostile on a longer term timeline. But like plagues, all sorts of issues, contaminations. Yeah. Leviathans, for example, are basically a metaphor for like nature does not care about you and is hostile to you. Like it doesn't like, a lot of the reasons why we have a civilization is because we found ways to tame, for example, seasons. Like it used to be you only got strawberries at certain times of the year. Now we have found places in the world where strawberries grow year round. We have built up a huge strawberry like agriculture there, and now we get strawberries year round. Like that's something that new. We have like tamed, for example, we have tamed sun. Now like tamed the sun. Now we have the sun indoors at all hours when we need it. If you wanted to grow plants with the like with these lights, you could. So I wanted for some of these settings to sort of speak to the hostility of nature, as well as frequently how in like even in the face of nature, human structures, human like civilization is often like improvised. It is something temporary that has been built up against it, but probably can never last against it. For the tainted, like Foundry side, for example, there's a space that is sentient that I won't spoil too much about, but I wanted to highlight how this was considered the absolute height of technology, but then was undermined by later technologies. That the, like, this is now almost a tomb, to how things used to be. This is empty. This is dripping. It's broken. For that, one of the things that I looked at a lot were the, like the buildings in Blade Runner, which seem to like inexplicably have these huge dark chambers full of chairs and like dining halls and like banquet stuff. I was like, this is his apartment building.
The apartment building. What's the character who makes the dolls and is the one who is?
Oh yeah, good evening, JG. Yeah, that guy. Home again. Jiggity jig.
His apartment building, which has appeared in so many films, is just like the atrium is gorgeous. Like the spacious nature of it feels almost like European, but then it's like so dystopic in the way that they present it.
Yeah, it feels really weird that like this guy's living in this dripping wreck of a building. That was what I wanted it to feel like because I wanted to show like an example of what happens when you think that you've won it and you're always going to be here. Things fall apart. You get undermined. Things get taken away and you're no longer the king anymore. And this is what's left because that's how technology works. That technology is almost like the favor of the gods. You only get it for a little bit, then it moves on. So yeah, like that really helps me figure out what shades I want to paint the world that the characters are moving through to sort of highlight what they're learning about the world, what they're learning about the consequences and like macro level, like tensions of the setting that they are moving through, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And then you have the macro scale, and then on the micro scale, you have the characters, and especially the POV characters, the ones whose eyes we're seeing the world through. How for you does character POV influence the description of the world itself and the ways in which readers perceive the world through the character's eyes?
Well, real quick, I realized that you had asked me something that I didn't answer. You asked me what are some of the pitfalls that someone could fall into. Right. Pitfalls is when you start to move from world building into ornament, which is putting hats on hats on hats. This is, I think, a real tough thing for writers to kind of get their heads around, which is, I think that the impulse is to build out the maps, the codexes, the races, the histories, to build out all this stuff. And you've done all this work, you might as well put it all on the page. And that get the way that feels is like when my kid plays a video game I've never heard of, and when he's sitting down to eat, he tries to explain the entire thing so he can explain this one thing that happened. And I'm like, buddy, yeah. What is this about?
I mean, like, not only do you have to explain, kind of like, mod? Yeah, but on top of that, you're like explaining the control system and like,
yeah,
stuff like that.
So I was leaning around. So there's lean, there's full lean. There's two different things. You can crouch lean, you can stand lean. And I'm like, dude, everything's getting cold here. That's what it feels like when someone is trying to like dump the world building on you. Because it's one thing to do like an info dump, which is when I'm telling you useful things. And then there's world building where, like, I'm telling you about shoes and feasts and songs. And you're like, but are they going to have sex? Is, like, what you're thinking in the moment. And so that I think, is the tricky thing, is to make sure that your world building is functional. The way I think about it is like a piece of engineering. Like, is like, this is the housing for the trolley system for the gear shaft or whatever. To try and ensure that things are firing right for the reader. Like, you don't want to lose them in any of this stuff. There are some people that I know, like, some people love all the info dumps that I do, like in Foundry Site, where I talk about the technology. Some people absolutely hate that shit. And so you, like, you've got to be aware, like, I might be losing them on this one. This might not be here for this. But I think that if you lean into world building as a system of, like, ornament, as, like, artifice, as garnish, I don't think people necessarily love that as much as everyone thinks that they do. In a game, in like a video game, where you're playing the person and you have like agency in choosing to explore this stuff, you can ignore it and just continue the main quest, or you can read all the books and go through all the shacks and the cabinets and things like that. That gives you a feeling of depth. You're like, wow, they really thought this through. But in a book, where you're being fed a stream of information, that's a lot less fun. And that's like why I think like fandom exists, is you can be like, if you want to have this greater depth here, it exists. If you want to read the Silmarillion, we compiled it for you.
Do you want to read the appendices? Go for it.
You want to read all the appendices? It's got a lot more stuff in there. But and so I think that you got to be aware of that first. What was the question that you asked after that?
Yeah, I mean, you led into it perfectly again, which is in terms of like the delivery system. I think like the delivery system is important, and using video games as an analogy is really perfect too, because it's like the agency that the player has in terms of the character they're controlling gives them a certain level of investment in that particular kind of experience. But in the book medium and in fiction, the experience is sort of given to you in a very front-to-end sort of way, where you have to engage with the character's perception of the world. And if you don't connect with that, then you're not going to connect with the book, period. And so for you, in terms of that character POV, how does that influence the description of the world and the ways in which the reader perceive that world?
A lot of that's in writing. A lot of that is in text itself. Like the way Din looks at things is like the way that I decided is he would be like a court stenographer, where he would be like, you know, like brown boots, green belt, blah, blah, like basically coldly and calmly dissecting the world in front of him to make an analysis at key moments when he's trying to measure someone up. It depends on sort of the effect that you want to imply. For example, to gently build up, like if I wanted to say that a place was like a tomb, because I want this to feel tomb-like, I want this to feel dead, I want it to feel trapped. I would start with like, you know, the smell of the air, the play of the light, as they sort of emerge like into the space and feel it first, to feel the atmosphere in the place and build to a metaphor of some kind to make it clear. Like, I feel like I'm in a catacomb whose roof has caved in, and that's the only source of light, or something like that. That can be very, like, that's critical in establishing mood. Mood and world building, though, can be very separate things, because world building, I think a lot, I think, to be quite frank, I think world building as a term gets overused a lot. I think that in science fiction and fantasy especially, it's more of a visual concept. It's the idea of feeling lost in a painting, of feeling feeling richness and fullness and depth of the secondary world that they've built out. You want to feel the work. But the way I think of, like, world building is you have to use it incredibly sparingly. That is the suggestion of depth off the page. But you can't have that be the whole thing. The way I think of it is a little bit like those shitty rides at Disney, the storybook rides, where you go around and you see, like, you know, world. It's a small world, but there are critical moments where you look out and you see whatever, like, display they want to show you. Plot and character come first. And there are moments where you have a brief window where you can have the audience and the characters look out and grow aware of the largeness of the world beyond, but not, like, you know, boom, history book, not do that. To suggest this broader macro struggle happening off the page. That, I think, is the best example of world building. The greatest example of this kind of stuff that I love to always point out is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, where there's all these little tiny tidbits literally like hanging off the page. That these little bite-sized moments that suggest, but never inform. That's great. It's tantalizing. It's a real, it's they're really toying with you. And like that's what the best world building is to be toyed with, to make your, like, imagination burn hot. That's the fun stuff. When they start to actually explain all that crap, like, you know, that's like the Star Wars prequels. Oh, it's mitochondria. That's
no, not mitochondria, fun. Man. Midichlorians. Come on.
Midichlorians. Sorry, midichlorians. Potato, potato.
I like that was actually a really good Freudian slip. Mitochondria. That's good.
Yeah, mitochondria.
It would have been better if George Lucas is like, yeah, they have little.
It's something
cell
in the mitochondria.
Yeah,
it's the power. Isn't that what it is? The cell.
It's like cells.
Pretty much. Yeah, yeah, but
yeah. All right.
I totally agree with you. Like, in terms of, I like how you use, like, It's a Small World and those kinds of rides as an example. I remember going to Disney once. No, it wasn't Disney. It was Universal. And we were on one of the Harry Potter rides at Universal. And the ride, like, broke down while we were in the middle of it. And they had to turn on the lights inside the ride in order to fix it. And that just
totally destroyed
my mind. The illusion was just destroyed completely. No. And so I feel like that for me was kind of one of those moments where it was like a perfect analogy for the illusion of world in fiction, in terms of what you're giving the reader.
Highly engineered.
Highly engineered and very purposeful. And then to have that experience where it's like, it just shatters your perception of what this thing is just heartbreaking.
It's like what I always like to try to think of is there was an interview about the movie Jaws where they were talking about how there were several shots, right, where if they held on the shark for a moment too long or a moment longer, it would all look fake now. And I always try to apply that to my own world building, right, where it's like we want to show just enough of the shark. I think that's great on world. I want to dive into character a little bit more specifically too, though, because you have really great character development throughout arcs in the trilogy from what I've seen so far in the Founders trilogy through Shorefall, I've heard it gets even more heartbreaking in Locklands. But even in just the single book arc of The Tainted Cup. So I want to talk about character development and how writers can use changing world dynamics to inform character arcs. Like, again, I call on Foundry Side and Shorefall, like with the changes that happen to T'Vaan between those two books and how it informs how the characters then behave. And then also, in your opinion, does the world need to have a world arc? Like the characters have character arcs. Is that something that you strive to create in your projects?
I don't think that they have to have a world arc. Like, the Tainted Cup, I don't think totally has a world arc, which I think is good. Like, these are small people doing, like, somewhat small things. This is a pretty, like, epic moment for Din and for, like, Anna. But they say again and again in the story, I'm doing a very small thing. There's a much larger battle taking place out there that is much more titanic, much more epic, and I'm doing this other little sideshow thing. And I think that that's good. I think we need more stories without superpowered people capable of leveling a city. We need less stuff that I put into Foundry Side, I guess is one thing I could say. But Foundry Side definitely has a world arc because, I was kind of obsessed with the idea of the way that a revolution starts and how it often doesn't work. People think, especially in America, that a revolution always goes one way. The good guys win. That's how that goes. But there's way more failed revolutions than there are successful ones. And I kind of wanted to have a character, especially in Shorefall, I'm not going to get too spoiling into that, who drops in and says, hey, I've done this thousands of times. It will never work. You cannot do this. There is no way to socially nudge humanity forward. There's no way to socially adjust them so they use technology for good. There is only might, will, power. You got to make them. You can't let them make up their own minds. You got to make up their own minds for them. And I wanted to make it clear that, like, all the things that happened in Foundry Side are not necessarily good for the city. Like, you come out of it thinking, like, wow, that was awesome. Things are great now. But, like, actually, people don't respond well to disruption like we think. We think that if, like, there's a big change, that people will embrace it and change with it. But mostly they don't. People want to just keep doing their own shit. They really, frankly, hate change, but they also hate the status quo, of course, which is one of the most frustrating things about people. And so I wanted to sort of highlight this push by all the Foundry Siders to try and crack open the regime and force equity, force a revolution, force them to like undermine the powers that be. But there's a real question that's floating over their heads, which is like, and then what? Like, you have to have something else that comes next. You can't just break things open and then good things will happen. You have to have like an educated social class that's like completely aligned with all the other like social classes that wants this to happen. Like, the thing that's weird about the like American like revolution is that a lot of like the upper class was cool with it too. It was upper class, lower class, and middle class all fighting on one side of one thing. That doesn't normally happen.
Yeah, like you have like a revolution like the October Revolution in Russia, where it was very much focused on the lower class. And then once the Bolsheviks came into power, a lot of what they did, they persecuted the upper classes, they persecuted the educated, or, you know, the people who were in the echelon of society that they deemed to be the enemy, basically.
Yeah.
And how did that turn? I mean, it turned into an empire, but.
But. Yeah.
Like, these things split very easily. These things often like diffuse. And it, like, I just kind of wanted to jump past all that because I think like a lot of people wanted me to write a series about like the history about how they would like introduce like the revolutions in the city. But I thought it'd be way more fun just to skip past that and have someone like float in and be like, no, this is not going to go the way you want it to. I'm just going to spoil this for you. This is not how people work, and you have misjudged everything. And that was far more interesting because, like, to kind of think about how people prompt change and how change comes from places that we don't normally think about, that was sort of the thesis of the novel, of the whole series, really.
Yeah. And a lot of what you're talking about involves systems. And I know you're big into systems. Like, you got magic systems on one hand, but then you have political systems and social systems and so much more. But I think one of the fascinating things are the ways in which these systems and the limitations that they present to the world intersect with character and plot development. And so for you, does having these systems and their built-in restrictions aid in plot development? Or how does, you know, maybe backing a character into a corner with your world building and systems help bring the character more to life?
I think that the way that I think of that, I think the way that I think about the way that I proceed is that the characters have to start off a little bit wrong about something. The main characters have to have a perception of the world that is not correct. That misperception will color how they proceed with a lot of the steps going forward. Like they might more or less do the right thing for the wrong reasons. And there will be points at times where the setting or like other characters will pipe up and say, you think it's one way, but I think this might be different. And slowly through the course of the story, they will realize at one point in time, I went about this entirely the wrong way. I thought that this was the way to do this. It's not. I thought that the empire was this thing, it this other thing. I thought that history was reliable. It's unreliable. And we have to like make up the world for ourselves rather than keep looking backward. But that's kind of the way that I structure these things, is to always think about like how people are so often wrong about themselves and about the world around them and the people around them. This is like, I think that books really are like, just like a math model. It's a model for trying to figure things out. And the only way you can figure things out is if you start off a little bit wrong, and then you can see how these human beings that you've created, who are facets of yourself, work their ways towards something resembling truth.
Very well put, sir.
Yeah, right. Well, speaking of putting things well, look at that transition, Adrian.
Damn, girl, your segue's getting good.
Another thing that you do really well in your work is dialogue. So I feel like just the characters come alive in some really, really wonderful ways through the dialogue that you give to them. So I want to ask, how do you use dialogue to reflect both the world and the character who's speaking? Like showing things, I'm thinking like showing stuff like cultural differences or differences in worldview between characters. And then, you know, similar, like how can writers leverage their world building details basically to enhance their dialogue?
Well, the first thing I would do is make sure that you use this stuff sparingly. Like we've all been in a meeting where there's this one guy who keeps telling jokes and you're like, could you like shut up? And like, this is fine, but we still have to get this done.
Like Chandler and Friends.
Yeah.
Sorry, Matthew Perry. Too soon.
Yeah. Sorry, Matthew Perry. Too soon. But yeah, like it's like, you know, like you don't want to have so many jokes that it actually bogs down the action of the story. That said, it is interesting. Like it's always fun to create perspectives that are in tension with one another, especially in tension with like how with like the larger questions of the setting. For example, in The Tainted Cup, in the sequel that I'm writing right now, because I can't remember any of the books that I've written previously, and the sequel that I'm writing right now, Din is very, you know, he's a little bit stiff. He is a reserved person, and he's got this concept of the empire as this like rigid place of order. But he's sent to some place at the edge of the empire where he meets someone whose concept of the empire is one of chaos, of one of rules that are like improvised, and they thrive there. They like it. They're like, this is how this is supposed to be. Like we have to do this crazy shit constantly. And their concept of rules is just way more flexible, way more liquid than his. And that's like, and that speaks to, I think, some of the tensions that are happening in that story, where it's this concept of like, the empire is bland, it's bureaucratic, it is temporary. A lot of this stuff is improvised. Like, I want something ancient, I want something with like dignity, I want something with history and like ancestry and all this cool stuff. Din is feeling this at the back of his head. And then this character is in there to be like, you're a fucking idiot. Like, why would, like, do you know the sorts of people who call upon, like, legacy and, like, ancestry? That's kings. And kings don't care about anything but kings. Like, they, like, it makes no sense that you would want this. I would love to have all this temporary stuff that you have, because to me it's a luxury. So, like, that's, like, I continue to think of stories as a conversation that, and you want to make sure that, like, it's trying to put together a panel. You want to make sure you have the right perspectives to produce an interesting conversation. And, like, a lot of it is curating, like what is a good flashpoint for these two people? Is it, like, sexual mores? That's always fun. People love that stuff. Is it food? Seeing other people eat? That's, like, that's something. As well as, you know, like, you know, I think we should kill this guy. And be like, wait a minute, we just can't kill anybody. I'm like, pretty sure we can. And I'm like, no one cares here. Like, those are sort of like you. So you kind of need to think of, like, the larger perspectives that are attention to the story, the sort of backgrounds that could bring those tensions to the 2 of 4, and then the flashpoints that make for fun conflicts to watch happen between two very different people. That's the fun bit.
Yeah, because it's like bringing the most out of a world is giving people different perspectives. It's like the reason that a conversation is interesting with another person and that you're engaged and that you're not just walking away like you're at some, like, Washington, D.C. socialite party where someone else is more interesting is because your lived experience and how it relates to that person's lived experience work together in such a way where it creates it creates dialogue, it creates little bits of conflict. Usually it's not, like, aggressive conflict. It's conflict that breeds curiosity. It's conflict that allows these two characters to reveal more about themselves bit by bit. And you, like, often in fiction it is aggressive conflict, but I think in real life, those conversations that you have where you're just like, I just want to hang out with this person for the rest of this party or for the rest of the evening. Or you leave somewhere and you're like, you know, you want to be friends with that person, or you want to be in a relationship with that person. Those things are based on the fact that the communication that you have with them is based in some foundation of difference, where those differences and the things that you're learning about them are engaging you enough to keep you going. And with a reader, yeah, those differences are going to keep them going. But instead of leading to, I'm going to become boyfriend or girlfriend or what have you with this person in real life, I'm going to read until the last fucking page of this book because it is
also
keeping me interested. It is hooked.
Book boyfriends are real.
Yeah. Are they, MJ? I've never.
Yeah. You can have book boyfriends or book girlfriends. You can have crush
whatever
on characters.
Floats your boat.
You've never had a crush on a character. You're a liar.
Oh, I have. Miranda in Mass Effect. She's
oh, okay.
Hot.
Well, that's everyone.
It's a video
but
game.
Also,
that's
but
all
also,
of us.
Yeah. But also Garrus. So, you know. Take
hell
take
yeah.
What you
that's my boyfriend.
Who's your book boyfriend, MJ?
Oh, I told you already. Hadrian from Swords. Yeah, right, Eric?
Yeah.
It's fine. Anyways.
You got this, girl. You're going 2024 is a new year. You can do whatever the fuck you want.
There we go.
Yeah. But I agree with you completely, Robert. I think, like, dialogue is that cool way where you can give these two characters, even if it's spoken dialogue or even if it's body language, this way to interact with each other and kind of evoke more about their personal stories, but also how they relate to the world. Whether it's someone who's like, I live in chaos, and Din's like, I can't handle this. Like, I cannot handle chaos.
Which, relatable. I am Din in this way.
I guess am I the chaos monster?
You might be the chaos one, yeah.
Am I the Anna to your Din? Is that what we've gotten?
Cute. Sure.
Yeah.
It's giving you a lot of credit.
Yeah, that is giving me way too much credit.
You are the mastermind, though, behind this. Yeah.
I'm going to start podcasting blindfolded. Fuck it.
I love it. Just don't rely on my memory. Yeah. It's nowhere near as good as Din's.
Yeah.
Neither. All right. Well, Robert, closing out, I want to ask if you have any final advice for authors related to world building, character building, and the way those things interact with each other.
A lot of it, like, it's like trying to prep a room for a party a little bit, and that they're like, in that if it works, like, ideally most world building people don't notice. There will be small things that work in the background that influence the actions of the characters and their perceptions of the story and the audience's perception of the story. But like real world, like there's pragmatic world building, which is like functional, like engineering does stuff on the page world building. Like that is important. And that's in every kind of literature out there. Like all literature, like Die Hard has practical, functional, like world building. And then there is genre world building, which is trickier and must be used much more sparingly, which is the moment on the ride where you get a glimpse out into something larger and stranger that you don't totally comprehend. And it is a fleeting moment, but it gets your brain cooking. That is it, like what it does is it suggests or inculcates an awareness of a larger world that is much more complex that you don't comprehend. That's fun. That's some really fun stuff. I think that like that, for example, is why a lot of like fantasy stories use epigrams at the start of their chapters. This little quote suggesting like rights and wars and conflicts and things like that, because they suggest and project a sense of depth that goes well beyond the page. So there's pragmatic world building, which has to tie into theme and all this other stuff, but is part of every story that is out there. And then the genre world building, which is your brief moment. The canvas is very small to paint something that really lights up their minds.
I like that. That distinction is really, really helpful. I don't know why I thought about Bob Ross and the way that he approaches painting. He's just like, I'm just going to put a little dab right there, you know? And
it's he fucks up all the time. He can do whatever he wants. You don't have to.
No, we can't all be Bob Ross, unfortunately. No. But all right, well, that's it for this mini masterclass and our two-parter with Robert Jackson Bennett. Thank you, good sir, for broadening our horizons with this fascinating topic. If you could please let people know where they can find you online.
I am at Robert J. Bennett on Twitter. I'm at something similar in Blue Sky and something else on Threads and Instagram. I'm there. You'll know it's me. Maybe not on Threads because I don't post it that much. You'll know me by the silence. I'll put it that way.
Whereas on Twitter, you'll know him by the snark and the
witty comments. Yeah. I don't think I'm a good hang on Twitter, but you can come try.
I think you're a good time on Twitter. I have fun just dropping comments here and there. Also, pick up Robert's books. The Tainted Cup is out now, so you can go get yourself a copy. It's a very, very fantastic book. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, all that jazz at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, what about you?
Yep, you can find me across all the major socials at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word, or just find all my stuff at mjkuhn.com.
Fantastic. And go buy MJ's books, Among Thieves, Thick as Thieves. You can get a free story if you sign up for a newsletter. Go check out that sham wizard and all of his shenanigans. It is a great time. For now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.